It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The State Justice Department has announced a $10 million settlement with a northeastern Wisconsin company over its failure to notify the state about PFAS contamination caused by firefighting foam. It was used at a training facility for years. The state is calling this settlement with Tyco Fire Products a monumental first step in holding PFAS polluters accountable. Under the settlement, Tyco must put $10 million into a PFAS trust fund to help clean up the toxic chemicals. And for the next 20 years, the company must provide clean drinking water to Marinette area residents with PFAS pollution in their wells. Tyco said in a statement Thursday it was pleased to have reached the deal, saying it, quote, reflects the extensive work Tyco has undertaken to address PFAS pollution. But some Marinette residents are underwhelmed by the settlement, and in just a bit we'll get a local perspective on the legal outcome. But first, we have Christy Remicall, professor of civil and environmental engineering at UW-Madison, where she leads the aquatic chemistry group and directs the water science and engineering lab. Christy, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, good morning.
Briefly, why is this class of thousands of human-made chemicals so concerning as a pollutant?
PFAS are a big issue in Wisconsin and many other places because these chemicals are toxic at very low levels. So some PFAS have been linked to things like decreased immune response and even cancer in some cases. And these concentrations are what we can find in the environment in some places. So toxicity is an issue. In addition, these chemicals are very persistent. So some chemicals like PFOS and PFOA do not degrade in the environment, as far as we know. That's why they're often called forever chemicals. So it's really the persistence and the toxicity combined that make these chemicals a concern.
Christy, as you look at this settlement, what stands out to you? What are your top takeaways?
Well, it's great to see some action on this. I know the community there has been waiting a long time for this. I think not everyone got what they wanted, I'm guessing, but I'm glad to see that there's some relief for people in the area.
So in terms of one aspect of the settlement, to provide clean drinking water and deal with discharges, where is Tyco at with that? And how difficult is that to do for this area?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's another thing that's really concerning and difficult with PFAS is that they're really hard to remediate. These chemicals are, I said, very persistent. They have a lot of carbon-fluorine bonds, which are essentially the strongest bonds you can have in an organic chemical. And that means our normal remediation processes don't work for PFAS. So they're really hard to break down. So a lot of the treatment that happens is not destructive technology. So it doesn't actually destroy the PFAS. Instead, it takes a PFAS from the water and captures it like on a filter. And then you have to do something with the filter. So a lot of the treatment that's happening there so far is relying on that type of basically filtration approach. The contamination is fairly extensive and it's going to take a long time to clean up.
How has this filtration been working for this community?
Yeah, so this is like activated carbon is what's most commonly used. I think it can be fairly effective at removing PFAS from water, but it doesn't destroy the chemicals that you have to do incineration or something like that. So I think another thing that's also challenging with groundwater contamination is, well, there's a lot of groundwater and it moves really slowly. So anytime we're doing any sort of groundwater remediation, it just takes a very, very long time.
In Tyco's statement, it said, since 2017, we have invested significantly in long-term solutions, including providing deep wells for clean, sustainable drinking water for our neighbors. Of course, in 2017, Tyco stops testing and doing its outdoor fire training that had foams containing PFAS at its Marinette facility. Can you talk more about what Tyco, what kinds of products are they making? What are they testing in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so they've been testing and are still testing indoors PFAS-containing firefighting foams, which we call aqueous film-forming foams, or AFFF. The type of foam that they primarily have used is made through fluorotelomer telomerization, and it uses a certain type of PFAS. For many decades, they did outdoor testing with limited containment of the foam, so that released a lot of this PFAS-contaminated foam into the surrounding environment.
Okay, so looking at the settlement, first suit, the company has settled with the state, but it has already settled other suits filed by public water systems around the country, as well as a group of Peshtigo residents. How does this settlement fit in or address different issues with PFAS?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, from my read on it, you know, they're investing $10 million into the PFAS Trust Fund to help clean up future contamination. So it is a little bit forward looking, in addition to dealing with some of the cleanup that they're already doing. And then in addition, providing deeper drinking water wells for some residents in the area to kind of get below the contaminated region. So it is, sort of another piece in the puzzle. There's a lot of contamination and a lot of things to address in the area.
Christy, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Christy Remicall is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at UW-Madison. She co-authored a study about PFAS levels in Wisconsin waters in 2024. Now we turn to Marinette resident Doug Oitzinger, president of the clean water advocacy group Save Our Water. Doug, welcome.
Good morning.
You were at the press conference yesterday hearing this announcement on the settlement. What was your reaction?
Well, we were both at the press conference and we had a private meeting with the Attorney General for about 45 minutes before the press conference. So, as you mentioned at the top of the show, we were underwhelmed. Now that I've had a chance to actually read the stipulation, I think the word I would say is we are deeply disappointed. It's worse than we thought.
In what ways? What is worse?
Well, there's a whole geographic area in the town of Peshtigo where contamination has been found, and the DNR and Tyco have been arm wrestling over whether or not this is Tyco's responsibility. It's called the Expanded Site Investigation Area, and Tyco has denied responsibility, and this settlement basically says, okay. So it kind of cuts the legs out from under the DNR in trying to get Tyco to own up responsibility for this. So what has been happening is those people have not been getting bottled water or new wells or anything at the expense of Tyco. It's been at the expense of the DNR, which is another way to say taxpayers. And that's going to be the law. That's going to be the settlement.
What would accountability look like to you? What would it look like to your group, Save Our Water?
Well, accountability would embrace all of the known and suspected impacts to the community. There's nothing in this settlement, for example, to do anything about health issues. We've had no health studies. The corporation hasn't said, hey, let's figure out how this has affected our residents or even our employees. So this is completely ignored in this settlement. There's just much more that the corporation could do. As was mentioned, PFAS is often referred to as a forever chemical.
Mm-hmm.
It's therefore a forever problem. And in my opinion, it's also a forever responsibility of the corporation that caused it. These chemicals don't exist in nature. If they're in the environment, it's because someone put them in the environment, whether they did it unknowingly or if they did it carelessly. In this case, we think, as your previous guest said, they would do this testing outdoors and wash it off of their concrete pad and into the surrounding landscape, which contaminated the groundwater. That was reckless.
Doug, this $10 million added to the PFAS Trust Fund, how much of an impact do you think can that money make on this environmental problem in your community and in other communities?
Well, first of all, we're going to have to fight for the money. It's not designated for the Marinette and Peshtigo area. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to lobby with the DNR to say, hey, that was a settlement for the contamination caused in our area. Please earmark this for projects in our area. As I mentioned, we're going to have to try to lobby for that money to go to those folks who were excluded from this settlement. There's no commitment for clean water in this extended site investigation area. So $10 million, to give you some reference point, it's about 0.3%. That's less than 1% of Tyco's profits in a year. It is the CEO of Johnson Controls is about $20 million a year. This $10 million sounds like a lot of money, but it's not when it comes to the cost of remediating this contamination.
Tyco has installed this groundwater filtration system, which the company says has treated hundreds of millions of gallons of water by pulling water from the ground, filtering it, returning it. Has that system eased your concerns at all?
That system is designed to try to mitigate the contaminated groundwater that is running into a ditch that feeds into the Bay of Green Bay. It is helping. It's a positive thing, but it does not treat one drop of water two blocks away. It does not treat one drop of water in the town of Peshtigo. So it is, it's a good thing. It's long-term, will have a positive effect.
But it's an isolated area.
It's an isolated area that impacts, it certainly impacts no one who has a contaminated well in the town of Peshtigo.
Doug, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Doug Oetzinger, Marinette resident, president of the Clean Water Advocacy Group, Save Our Water. We've been talking about the State Justice Department's settlement deal yesterday with Tyco Fire Products. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, the campaign trail is heating up with President Trump's visit to Chippewa County today. What does it mean for Republicans running for office? The team from Inside Wisconsin Politics weighs in on the president's visit to Wisconsin and the political dynamics heading into the midterms. That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Campaign season is heating up with President Trump expected to visit Chippewa County today to highlight efforts in rural Wisconsin. It's his first visit to the state since he won election in 2024. But with Trump's approval rating at historic lows and gas and grocery prices high, his visit puts Republican candidates in a bind over how closely they want to align themselves with the White House. Our team of political reporters at Inside Wisconsin Politics break down the ramifications of Trump's visit for Republicans running for office. Joining the discussion are WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, PBS Wisconsin Senior Political Reporter Zach Schultz, and WPR Political Reporters Anya Van Wagtendonk and Rich Kramer.
So, Zach, as we record this program right now, we just know that President Trump is coming to Wisconsin. It's a big deal anytime the president comes to your state, but it seems to be an especially big deal now. What's different about this visit here in this point in 2026?
Well, this is campaign visit. I mean, in the past, you could look at the president's visit, it's more about himself. This time, you can kind of look at it in terms of what does it mean for the fall, or in one particular race in northern Wisconsin that Rich will, I'm sure, be talking about, what it means for that primary in August. But specifically, we're looking at which Republicans show up with them. Now, we expect them all to be there, all the big names. But if you look back in history, more on the Democratic side, there is a history of some candidates not really not sure if they want to sit next to an unpopular president in a midterm election. In 2000, 2010, President Obama came to Madison. There was a big question of whether Russ Feingold was going to appear on the stage. In the end, he did. But all the weeks leading up to it, his campaign wasn't sure. He might be in Africa. He had some other things going on. And that was really a political question of, does he want to be seen with him? And he ended up losing that race. That was the Tea Party wave before it was. Just 2 years ago, President Biden visited Madison off that disastrous debate performance. Tammy Baldwin was elsewhere. She didn't come to Madison to be with the president. That's about campaign optics.
We should game out some of these names who might or might not be there in just a minute. But Rich, you are the closest to where the president will be. You're in Eau Claire. He's going to be in Chippewa County. What's the significance of where he's going to speak and, you know, potentially what he's going to talk about?
So Chippewa County kind of serves as a twofer for the president and for Republicans. So it is essentially a county that has two congressional districts. To the north side of it, we're talking about the 7th congressional district. That is the seat that Congressman Tom Tiffany is vacating as he runs as a governor for Wisconsin. And then to the south of that line, it's the 3rd congressional district, and that is Republican Derek Van Orden. And he's in the middle of a pretty competitive reelection campaign, and it's just one of a small handful of seats that are considered toss-ups. I mean, we're talking across the entire nation. And he's running against someone who came pretty close in 2024, Rebecca Cook. She was within 3 percentage points in a year that President Trump won the state. So it's a different dynamic now. He needs all the help he can get, and the White House is responding in kind.
And it seems like the message from the White House has been, we're going to talk about farmers. We're going to talk about agriculture in these settings, in this district. Anya, what can we make of that?
I mean, we're talking about sort of the steep odds that the ruling party, the Republican Party, is facing right now. Obviously, the president right now has some of his lowest approval ratings throughout his time in office. But farmers in particular have really helped deliver him victories. I believe in his last election, he won the vast, vast majority of sort of farm-dependent counties in the country. And yet, a lot of his policies, tariff policies in particular, have really been connected with some of the pain that farmers have been feeling. So tariffs that have caused, you know, weakened overseas markets for corn and soy, and then increased prices on steel and aluminum. So we have seen changes in his policies in ways that are, I think, aimed really directly at trying to appeal to these farmers. Earlier this week, he signed an executive order to lower some tariffs on agricultural equipment in particular. And so now he's coming to Wisconsin to talk directly to farmers and kind of try to make sure that that part of his base is secure.
But Zach, as you mentioned, he is not coming for himself. He's not saying, vote for me. He is coming to a county that straddles a couple districts, including, as Rich mentioned, our most competitive in Wisconsin. He's also coming at a time where, if you just look at the latest national poll from Marquette University, he has 19% of voters approve of how he's handling gas prices, 22% on the cost of living. The economy is around 30%. His overall rating is at a record low, 38, with disapproval creeping up. Is that good for someone like Derek Van Orden?
It doesn't help, but I think that the difference between these Republican candidates specifically and past examples like Tammy Baldwin or Russ Feingold is the Republicans need this area and they need Trump's voters to come out. When he is not on the ballot, Republicans across the state struggle to get turnout, especially in western and northern Wisconsin. That is the MAGA base of this state in the 7th and the 3rd. And without those voters, they could really struggle in the fall. So they actually need to attach themselves even closer to Donald Trump at this point, even if it looks like, politically speaking, it may not be the smartest move because of his terrible numbers on a lot of things. And I'd like to meet the 19% of people who think gas prices are good right now, unless they are all biking or not driving themselves. There's really no one I've talked to in a while that says gas prices are doing great.
You wonder if they're kind of like, you know, biting their lip a little bit when they say that they're happy with that. Rich, what do you make of this visit here?
Well, I wanted to go back and mention the 7th Congressional District. I failed to mention that. Well, so this is the seat that Tom Tiffany's giving up to run for governor. But there's a big Republican primary going on right now up there. And Michael Alfonso who is Sean Duffy, U.S. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy's son-in-law, has already been endorsed by President Donald Trump. So some of the Republicans, other Republicans in that race, are trying to use Alfonso's connections against him. So I guess Trump coming to here, if Alfonso shows up, which I would expect he would, you get the president talking about this person that a lot of people in northern Wisconsin might not know about yet, and also takes a little bit of the wind out of the sails of the Republican challengers that haven't dropped out yet after that endorsement came way back in January.
Yeah, so let's talk about a few of the people who might or might not be at this event. And depending on when you watch or listen to this show, you're going to know whether we got these answers right. So cut us some slack if we get anything wrong, okay? Michael Alfonso, you mentioned, it's in the 7th District. He is kind of the Trump candidate. That's his thing. So I think in that conservative district, I would be very shocked if he was not there to cheer on the president. I think we've seem to be hinting that we expect Derek Van Orden to be there, you know, a very strong Trump supporter going for that Trump voter who might stay home. How about Tom Tiffany, the Republican candidate for governor running in 50-50 Wisconsin? Anyone want to take a stab at that?
I think he's got to be there. I don't know why he wouldn't. It's next to his district. He's already tied himself to Trump over and over and over. And he, like Van Orden, needs that turnout in northern Wisconsin that Trump can deliver that really no one else can. So it would be really odd, considering his past moves on election denials and all the other stuff where he's this closely related to Trump, including just voting to, in Congress, not end the war in Iran. Supporting Trump again in that area in a very unpolitical fashion in terms of like popularity. So I would be surprised if he wasn't there.
Any dissenters there? We think that Tiffany's probably going to be there.
I assume so.
Well,
I mean, getting the endorsement, I think, was like a really big deal for the Tiffany campaign, right? It made him sort of the heir apparent to the Republican path to the governorship. But he has been trying to thread this needle a little bit. And, you know, as Democrats try to really closely tie him to Trump to say that he is, yes, he's aligned with those politics and some of those value systems, but he is not sort of in lockstep with Trump. And he doesn't always vote with him 100% of the time. He made a sort of point of that at this appearance that he made in Madison a week or two ago. And so he wants to kind of show that he, yes, he's in line with those values, but also he will put Wisconsin first. And so how does he thread that needle at the visit? Again, maybe our viewers will already know and we'll be waiting to see.
Right. Rich?
I'm sorry I stepped on what Anya was saying, but I have seen some folks online point out, well, Tiffany has taken some small little stances against the war, you know, saying it needs to be wrapped up soon, et cetera. So they're arguing, well, that's him putting a little bit of daylight between himself and the president. But as we know, he has been pretty much in lockstep for a long time. So I do expect him there, but there's a part of me that is very contrarian and wants to push back just because you all say he's going to be there. But so if he's not, maybe it would be because he's trying to appeal to the general election audience.
All right. Well, now that I got the three of you on the record and I didn't take a position, I think we should move on to the next topic, the candidate filing deadline in the race for governor. You had candidates for governor, attorney general, Congress, assembly, Senate, you name it, filing their nomination papers in Madison ahead of this week's deadline. Nothing is final yet, Anya, but which you should explain to us. But we knew going in, there's a big field of people who said they were going to run for governor. What is sort of the lay of the land right now?
Yeah, so, you know, a million caveats about the various steps of review that they will go through with the Elections Commission. But as of right now, 8 Democrats have filed their papers, 2 Republicans. And so that's a field of 10. Tom Tiffany sort of being the kind of obvious frontrunner on the Republican side, less of an obvious frontrunner on the Democratic side. And then the big open question going into the filing deadline was whether Kirk Bengstad, the owner of Minocqua Brewing Company, this kind of liberal activist and perhaps social media provocateur, we might say, whether he was going to get his papers in on time. He declared his candidacy just a few weeks ago. He got his signatures in. It seems that about a quarter of them, if not more, are not valid. So they didn't contain either the right voter information for the signers. And then about 40 pages of them didn't have the right date of the election. So he has until Sunday to cure those. That is a tall order that involves filing affidavits. He can't just like go out and get 500 new signatures. So that's the big question. And then the Elections Commission will kind of vote and see whether everyone else qualifies. So as of right now, it seems that there are 7 qualified Democrats, 2 qualified Republicans, and then the Kirk Bankstead question.
Right. And it's a big question, not only for Kirk Bankstead, it seems, but I mean, we're talking about what kind of a primary this is going to be, because let's say you're a candidate who wants to occupy that left flank of a 7-candidate Democratic primary like Francesca Hong. Kirk Bankstead comes in and is attacking you from the left, saying you're not left enough. He could pull away a few votes and it could make all the difference in a primary this big, Zach.
It's possible. I mean, we are talking about a primary. If we get 7 candidates going all the way to August, that, you know, it's not unreasonable to think that high 20 percentage might be the winner if things get split pretty evenly. It really depends on whether those last 3 or 4 candidates at the bottom of the barrel are pulling 2% or if they're pulling 5 or 6%, because those can add up to a big enough chunk of the electorate that they can swing an election towards the top when there may not be anyone that's really run away with it so far. Bankstead is not something that most of the Democrats are taking seriously. They look at him as more of an online troll. Provocateur is a good, polite word. They don't always use polite words when they're talking about him. Republicans love having him in the conversation because he's just more ammunition for them to throw at Democrats. Democrats would like him out of the conversation for that very reason.
So I guess I assumed when we were looking at this race way back in, I don't know, January, maybe last year even, that by June, when it comes time to file signatures, maybe that hurdle right there would thin the field a bit, and it basically did not. Do you all think that this field will be smaller before people vote in August, that you'll have some candidates say, look, I know I'm on the ballot, but I'm dropping out of this race, and I'm throwing my support behind someone else? Rich, you want to take a stab at this one?
Well, I would, you know, you would expect that the field would shrink a little bit, but also this is an open seat, so it's kind of a different ball game. And, you know, why not keep going? We've got candidates that in polling have been hovering around 1%, you know, single digits essentially, and they're still in it. And I can't help but think of 2022. It was a U.S. Senate race against Ron Johnson, and you had the majority, you know, you had the Democratic candidates all drop out all at once and endorse Mandela Barnes, who is now running for governor. But I really don't expect to see anything like that this go round. I could be wrong, but it just seems like the cost benefit analysis that they're reviewing these Democratic candidates is leading them to stay in it.
And by contrast, you know, in 2018, the last time that there was a big open Democratic primary for governor, it was an even more crowded field. I think there were 2 dropouts, and it was still a larger field than it currently is. And Evers emerged from that, Governor Tony Evers, with a decent chunk of, but not a majority of the votes. He didn't have more than 50%. And so we could be seeing sort of a similar dynamic throughout the summer. One of the big questions, of course, is who can maintain the money that it takes to kind of get through to August. But especially if you see yourself as kind of standing out from the pack of like occupying a lane to yourself, why not kind of keep running in that way? To your point, will there be then when people do start dropping out? And I do think we're going to see some before the primaries, but there's going to be some trading. Like there's going to be backdoor discussions. I know everyone hates talking about how those happen in politics, you know, to trade my support for you. And so that'll be really interesting to see who wants to kind of give it up this time in exchange for something else down the line.
Yeah, the 2 things to look at ahead of those are, one, staffing. If we see, because we get the emails, the press releases, we know who their campaign staffers are. I would never expect the general public to have an idea of who these people are. But if we see changes in staffing, then that means they don't have the money to pay them, or those people are moving on to a new race or a new position. It really doesn't cost much to run for governor. In Wisconsin, it's gas money, which I know is more than has been in past years, but it's still, it's not that difficult. And it's not even that difficult to get 2,000 signatures, if quite honestly. We have lots of candidates. You just go out and knock doors and anyone will sign something we put in front of them. The other thing to look at is is there a reason that consolidation might actually keep someone else from doing something in a race? And if they actually have enough support to throw behind someone else and kind of make that move or bargain for them, they almost have enough leverage to like say, I can deliver my voters, or my name comes with enough people to make it worth this effort.
The one thing I'd add to everything that you all have said is that I think the 22 experience could discourage some people to stay in, to drop out. What I mean is that the idea in 2022 is we're all going to get behind this one candidate. Everybody put aside your political ambitions and back Mandela Barnes. It didn't work out for Mandela Barnes, you know? And so those candidates who dropped out maybe look at that and say, hey, why not me? They could be having a similar calculation this time around. Real quick before we wrap up, and we'd give more time to this if this was a bigger decision, but we have to address this Wisconsin Supreme Court decision briefly, Rich. They dealt with this redistricting case on the congressional map. Was it a momentous decision or incremental? You know, you tell me.
It was not momentous.
Yeah.
People might get excited when they see, oh, they're taking up this redistricting appeal. But really what they were addressing is whether or not a three-judge panel that they appointed made the right decision in dismissing this lawsuit. What's interesting about this lawsuit is it's not arguing that the congressional map is a partisan gerrymander. It's saying, no, this is an anti-competitive gerrymander. So a different kind of nuanced approach, but ultimately they want new maps. So this doesn't mean that they're going to be issuing any decisions anytime soon. It would be shocking if anything came before the elections this year.
Yeah, never say never in politics, but it does not feel like at this moment the kind of redistricting moves you're seeing in other states around the country right now. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us.
That was a roundtable discussion with WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, PBS Wisconsin Senior Political Reporter Zach Schultz, and WPR Political Reporters Anya Van Wagtendonk and Rich Kramer. Wisconsin Today airs the Inside Wisconsin Politics podcast every Friday. You can also download it and watch it at both WPR.org and PBSWisconsin.org. Coming up, Wisconsin's first independent bookstore crawl is underway. Thanks to Iowa for the inspiration.
Bookstores from Iowa were talking about how great their bookstore tour is, and they convinced me that we should have one in Wisconsin. So I reached out to a few other bookstore owners. We put together a little group and organized it.
Wisconsin's Indie Bookshop Quest, that's next on WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. The Cozy Inn Chinese Restaurant first opened on Janesville's West Milwaukee Street in 1922. The restaurant has long been regarded as likely the second oldest Chinese restaurant in the country, only behind the Pekin Noodle Parlor in Butte, Montana. But in April, the Noodle Parlor closed its doors, making the Janesville establishment the new title holder. Cozy Inn owner Tom Fong sat down with Rob Ferret to reflect on what makes the restaurant so special.
All right, you are part of restaurant history here. The Cozy Inn opened its doors in 1922. How does it feel now to have the title of the oldest continually operating Chinese restaurant in the country?
It's a little surreal. I never really thought about the longevity of the restaurant.
And your time at the Cozy Inn first started as a kid working alongside your parents. What are some of your earliest memories of the restaurant?
We went through a lot of struggles, a lot of obstacles and challenges, because my mom didn't speak English very well with my stepdad. So it was just basically my brother and I and the business at the time when my mother bought the business. It wasn't very busy at all. I think the previous owners, they just sort of maybe mentally got just tired of the business, and they just sort of let it slide. And we had to try to resurrect the business again. And as a 14 and a 16-year-old, it was a challenge.
What do you think were some of the changes you made at that time, you and your brother and your mom made at that time, that helped revive it and helped it survive? Because restaurants don't always survive.
Correct. You're really right on the money about that. When we first came to Janesville, my mom was sort of a trailblazer in Milwaukee because she was a head chef in many Chinese restaurants, popular Chinese restaurants in Milwaukee. And that was sort of unheard of as a woman becoming a head chef. And so when she came to Janesville, we brought these different Cantonese dishes.
Well, I want to get hungry now. Can you name some of those Cantonese dishes she brought over?
Sort of things like the Cantonese chow mein. In fact, I don't think there's not too many that have them here locally. I think we're the only one that has that dish. And things like sweet and sour pork, the way we prepare our pork is totally different from the other restaurants. We do it the old style, the Hong Kong style.
What's the Hong Kong style?
It's sort of like a dry flour type deep fried, and where the other ones use like a wet flour, like a wet breading, sort of like you find like on fish fries, that kind of a batter. Ours is sort of a drier type, totally done differently.
And Tom, you know, public radio, we've been around over 100 years here, and we hear people, you know, started listening with their parents or their grandparents. Is it like that at the Cozy Inn where you've got, you know, people, maybe they started eating there at age 2 and now they're bringing their kids or their grandkids in?
Yes, I've seen like 5 generations. And after a while, these, you know, I just speak to a lot of them, and being in the restaurant, it becomes nostalgic to them. They make memories at in those booths. They sit and they talk and they laugh.
And now, what are your hopes for the future of Cozy Inn?
We feel loyal to this community, so we don't really want to shut down. And by the time I've been there like 52 years personally, you know, on and off, but mainly I've been there since 1974. And my wife's been there 38, but we're hopefully we can find like a relative or something and take over once we get too old.
Well, good luck with those future plans, Tom, and thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
That was Tom Fong speaking with Wisconsin Today host Rob Ferret. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. This is WPR News. Dozens of independent bookstores in Wisconsin are participating in the first statewide bookstore crawl in this month of June. It's called Bookshop Quest 2026. The month-long event features a map of local independent bookstores around the state with missions to undertake and clues to decipher in the stores. In Wisconsin, 77 independent bookstores are part of the Midwest Independent Booksellers Association. And according to the American Booksellers Association, local bookshops, they're going through a massive resurgence across the country, and that vitality is being noticed around Wisconsin as well. To learn about the indie bookstore scene in our state and the bookstore crawl, we have Keith Burrows, co-owner of Republic of Letters Bookstore in Mineral Point and an organizer of Bookshop Quest 2026. Keith, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here.
Where did this idea for an independent bookstore crawl in Wisconsin come from?
Well, the independent bookstore community is so tight-knit. And at a conference in the fall, a couple bookstores from Iowa were talking about how great their bookstore tour is, and they convinced me that we should have one in Wisconsin. So I reached out to a few other bookstore owners. We put together a little group and organized it.
What have you learned about how Iowa did its bookstore crawl?
Well, they do it regions. They do the, like, you can do a northern card or a southern card and fill them out. We decided we really wanted to encourage people to go all over the state. So we decided to just do one big map, and we, you know, maybe you're not going to visit all 35, but you can try and get to as many stores as you can.
And those 35 bookshops, they're all over the map, all over Wisconsin.
All over, pretty much covered the state.
So what do you hope that this bookstore crawl accomplishes?
It's about celebrating the variety of independent bookstores, because I think that's one of the things that's great about independent bookstores is you have a small team or maybe just one person who's choosing what books to carry, choosing what events to host, choosing how they fit into their community. And so they're all very different. So, for example, I have a store in Mineral Point, and in our store, we share our space with a cooking school, the Book Kitchen. So they do cooking classes, mostly based around cookbooks, and have chefs and cookbook authors come through. Another store that's participating in the tour in Madison is Wanderlust, and that's a mobile bookstore that's romance novels only. Or you have Leopold's, which is a bookstore, bar, cafe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just such variety. And Wisconsin is such a beautiful state. And June is a fantastic time to be out and about in Wisconsin. So we thought it'd be great to pair discovering your new favorite bookstore with some time outside in Wisconsin.
Give us a feel for these missions. What did you dream up here that bookstore enthusiasts will puzzle out on this quest?
Yeah, we didn't want it to be just visit a bookstore, check it off.
Yeah.
So we have these side quests that include things like meeting bookstore pets. So that could be a dog or a cat. You know, maybe that bookstore has a fish tank. Whatever animal you can find in the bookstore, that'll count as the pet. Or maybe ask a bookseller for a recommendation. That's another one of the side quests. Pretty easy to accomplish. Gets you another chance to win a prize, but gets you talking to somebody.
As a bookstore owner, what is it like to create clues inside your store that are unlike your regular retail book display work?
Well, it's we're learning as we're going, so it's been a lot of fun. It feels very it's a new way of advertising our stores and attracting customers and making the space fun to visit. So I'm hoping that people will agree with us.
We see these indie bookstores on main streets all over the state. What can we learn by visiting an independent bookshop, you know, in a community outside of our own?
I think bookstores are often the heart of our community, of our main street. And if you go to a bookstore and you need a recommendation for where to get coffee or where to go for a bite to eat, the bookstore is a great place to ask. It's also a great place to meet people. And that's what I really love about running a bookstore, is the opportunity to really have a conversation. Everyone who comes in the bookstore is going to have something that they'd like to talk about with me. So there's always that meeting point. And it's not uncommon for us to then recommend other stores for them to visit, or to call up a friend to have them open up their art gallery for visitors who are maybe in town on a slow day. You know, our job is to be a bridge in the community.
Almost like an ambassador in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's a good way of thinking about it.
I wonder, too, these conversations you have with people who come into the store, they are also building maybe what you end up putting on display or stocking in the store, because they come with their own influences.
Absolutely. We have, there's two big influences on what we carry. One is what our customers are interested in, and the other is what we are passionate about and what we really want to sell. And those two things to come together to make each store's curation unique.
Wisconsin is home to 77 independent bookshops that are part of the Midwest Independent Booksellers Association. What is the health of this industry in Wisconsin?
Good. I'm never sure. It's never been an easy job to run a bookstore. And there's lots of challenges, inflation and increased costs of everything, and competition with Amazon and other booksellers. But people value independent stores. They value that experience. And we've been seeing more and more independent bookstores open up in the state. I don't know exactly how many, but at least a dozen in the last year. So I think it's there's a strong future.
Can you say more about how independent stores are carving out a space in a market where consumers can get any book they want shipped directly to their door or downloaded to their device instantly?
Absolutely. And, we try to serve both that need. So a lot of independent bookstores will have a website where you can order books, or they'll be partnered with bookshop.org, where you can order one of the 15 million books that bookshop.org has in stock. But I have about 5,000 books in my store, and so it's a very limited selection of the available books. About 2,000 books are published every week.
Wow.
Now, a lot of those are textbooks or other things, but we're doing a lot of curation, and so you can use an independent bookstore both to order whatever book you already know you need, or to really find something new and lean on that expertise of that bookseller. We really like to help people find a book that'll change their life.
Mm.
You mentioned this is a difficult economy. There is inflation, there's tariffs, there are other headwinds with online booksellers. What have you felt as a bookseller in this economy?
You know, it is a tough economy, but one of the main reasons it's a tough economy is because it's a tough economy for our customers. You know, their costs are going up, their income isn't going as far. And we see that, and we try to respond to that. So a lot of bookstores will make sure to include a lot of free programming. Every independent bookstore I know is perfectly happy for you to come in and spend some time, and there's no expectation that you're walking out of there with a bag full of books. We have lots of comfortable seating in our store for a reason. We want you to spend some time in the space. We have to provide value that justifies the cost to you, and that's what we try to do.
But are your costs going up?
Absolutely. Everything from book costs have been going up and up with paper costs, printing costs, delivery costs. A lot of the suppliers, publishers, and distributors have been adding surcharges for fuel costs. Everything we pay has gotten more expensive.
Even very small communities can support a local independent bookstore. Like your own community of Mineral Point has roughly 2,500 residents. Why do you think that is?
Well, books are not a new idea. They've been around and been popular for a long time. And I think in our digital saturated world, where more and more people are finding the value of having something that doesn't have ads in it and that doesn't require you to be on a screen and just gives you that time and space to focus and be with that book. And we're not a big store, so we don't have really high rent, and so we can be in a small community and right-sized for our community.
Do you think that is the case for other small communities around Wisconsin, that they can make it work regardless the size of how many people live there?
Absolutely. If you're a very small town and there's no tourism, that obviously gets hard. But any city of any size should have a bookstore. Absolutely. Yeah.
Speaking of tourism, how does this bookstore crawl fold into the element of tourism? What do you envision?
Well, Wisconsin is a diverse and beautiful state. You have beautiful North Woods, the Driftless area, the lakes, like Lake Michigan. I moved to Wisconsin 21 years ago in June, and I just fell in love with the state. And I think it's the perfect time of year to go out and see all the beautiful corners of our state.
Well, Keith, happy bookstore crawl to you, and I hope BookQuest goes really well.
Thank you. I look forward to seeing you in the store.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That is Keith Burrows, co-owner of Republic of Letters Bookstore in Mineral Point. He's an organizer of the inaugural statewide bookstore crawl in Wisconsin. It's called Bookshop Quest 2026, and it runs through this month with 35 independent bookshops participating across the state. And you can give a shout out to your local bookshop, or maybe you've got your indie bookshop map and started your quest. Email us about bookstores in the state. Send your note to wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Next week on the show, we meet 9-year-old Levi, who recently biked 1,400 miles with a bunch of his family members. You heard right, 1,400 miles, starting in Central Park in New York City and finishing in Madison. What an incredible feat. And we want to hear about your family biking adventures. Where did you go? Did you complete the journey? And how did a young person do along the ride? Or maybe you're planning a biking trip now for the summer. Also, do you have favorite biking trails you like to go on in Wisconsin? Email us your story and your tips about biking. We'd love to share them on the program. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text us. That number is 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Mackenzie Crummy and Joe Tarr. Our acting executive producer is Tim Peterson. Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Brad Kohlberg. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.